Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. The Democratic National Convention begins today in Philadelphia, and KUOW's David Hyde is there at Roosevelt Park near the convention center where protesters have gathered. David, hello.
Hey, how's it going, Bill?
It's good. And before we get to the protest, what's happened at the convention so far today?
Well, Bernie Sanders met with supporters earlier today, including supporters here from Washington State. The event was closed to the press, but they tell me that he told delegates some of the same things he's been saying all along. The Democratic Party needs to unite at this point to defeat Donald Trump. One of the Bernie delegates from Washington State, Andrew Shogren, told me that that candidate is Bernie Sanders, and he points to some polls today out showing that Hillary's maybe trailing Donald Trump.
Now, Bernie Sanders won the caucuses here in Washington State, as we all well know, and his supporters have complained since that the Democratic Party has ignored them and the system is rigged in Clinton's favor. What are Washington delegates saying about these emails that have been leaked showing Democratic Party officials favoring Clinton?
They're ticked off about WikiLeaks. They're ticked off about the vice presidential nominee. You know, they're not happy at this point. That's all I can tell you.
David Hyde is at Roosevelt Park. As I said, David, will you paint us a picture of that spot?
Yeah, I'm looking around right now. There's families, there's tents, there's people with dogs, there's American flags, there's right-wing protesters, there's Jill Stein signs, and the crowd is just kind of starting to gather now. It's expected to build over the course of the day, and I think Jill Stein is anticipated to speak here around 5 p.m. Eastern time.
What are you seeing right now?
Like I said, looking out, balloons, protesters, peace signs, Bernie or bust signs, kind of what you might expect at a political protest. And actually, we're right next to the fences separating the protesters from the convention center. Although I have to say, with the proximity, it's pretty close. You can see it all from right here. The tents and all of that is sort of set up about 100 yards away.
I understand there's one of the protesters there. You've lined up to talk with us?
Yeah, Jonathan Tong is a school teacher from Kenmore, Washington, and he traveled all the way to Philadelphia to send a message.
I'm talking with KUOW's David Hyde, who's at Philadelphia now for the Democratic National Convention, and Jonathan Tong is about to come on the line with us. Jonathan?
Hey, Bill. How's it going?
Good. Good to talk with you. You went from Kenmore, Washington, to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, to send a message, and what's your message?
I did. I'm a high school teacher from Washington State, and I came here to help my students and my two teenage daughters get the democracy they deserve.
What do you mean, the democracy they deserve? What are you asking for?
Well, most people, whether they're Bernie supporters or Hillary supporters, would agree with former President Jimmy Carter and Princeton study that was done last year that we don't actually have a functioning democracy in this country. We have an oligarchy, a government that's controlled by a small number of very wealthy, politically powerful people.
And how do you take down or change an oligarchy?
To me, the big issue is big money in politics. Again, whether you're a Hillary supporter or Bernie supporter or even a Trump supporter, polls overwhelmingly show that the one thing that everyone agrees on across the spectrum is that there's too much money corrupting our system, and that's for both parties. So what I came here to do was raise public awareness of this and maybe reframe the narrative so that it isn't so much about Bernie versus Hillary or Hillary versus Trump, but the 1% who are running everything in this country versus the other 99%. That's what this week should be about.
And there you are protesting. Do you feel like you can bring about change through the electoral process and our party system?
That's what I'm hoping so. And that's what the thousands of other people who came here from all over the country are hoping for, too. We're just doing whatever we can to make a difference.
Do you plan to get arrested?
I personally am not planning to get arrested, but I am working with Democracy Spring, and I am supporting the folks who are willing to risk arrest for this.
Well, today Bernie Sanders asked you to vote for Hillary Clinton. Will you do that?
I have not ruled out the possibility of voting for Hillary come November, but that's 3 months away. So me personally, I'm figuring we got 3 months between now and then, and I want her and the rest of the party to work a little bit harder to earn my vote.
Well, as you know, Democratic Party officials are saying don't wait for 3 months. We need to show unity now. The Republicans showed some disunity last week, and that made national headlines, the booing of Ted Cruz, etc. How do you know you're not in dangerous territory here showing disunity at a time when the DNC wants to make this a show of togetherness?
Because I'm putting the needs of my country before the needs of my party. I've been registered as a Liberal Democrat for 35 years. But to me, again, I'm more concerned about the unity of our country over the unity of our party.
Washington
Only
State.
3 months. 3 months mm-hmm. is a long time. I'm willing to have that conversation in October.
Well, Washington State, as you well know, went for Bernie Sanders here, and there were a lot of complaints from Sanders fans saying the system is rigged in favor of Hillary Clinton. What do you think about these leaked emails that show party officials favoring Clinton? What effect did those emails have on you?
I think it confirms what we all pretty much knew from the beginning. When they scheduled the first debates to be at times that were guaranteed to have minimum viewership, we kind of knew that they were rigging the system already, so this just kind of confirms it.
Okay, finally, Jonathan Tong, a lot of us are wondering what kind of protests there are going to be this week at this convention. What can you tell us? What are your plans for the week?
I will be here supporting wherever I can. There are lots of different groups and lots of different organizations that are having rallies, that are having marches. I'm here mainly with Democracy Spring. It's the same group that organized the mass sit-ins at the Capitol building back in April, and they are planning direct actions every day this week. I will be supporting there.
With Democracy Spring, that's Jonathan Tong, school teacher from Kenmore, Washington, traveled to Philadelphia to join protests at the Democratic National Convention. Jonathan, thank you for that.
Thanks, Bill. Hey, Kate, can I add one more thing?
Yes.
Can I encourage your listeners to vote yes on Initiative 735 and Initiative 1464 on the November ballot? Because those are both ballot initiatives that also would go a long way to helping get big money out of politics.
Thank you, Jonathan. Our listeners will find coverage of our November ballot issues and candidates at our website, KUOW.org. KUOW's David Hyde and Kate Walters are there in Philadelphia this week. And if you have convention questions, send your email to newsroom@KUOW.org. Finally, the FBI has just said today it's investigating how those thousands of Democratic National Committee emails were hacked. Hillary Clinton's campaign says it was committed by Russia for the benefit of Donald Trump. The FBI confirms it's investigating a cyber intrusion involving the Democratic National Committee. We'll keep following that here on KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. If anybody should drive electric cars, it is us, right? Pacific Northwesterners. We're tree huggers. We've got river power. Why don't we see more EVs on the road? Here's KUOW's Tom Bonsi.
Eavesdrop with me for a moment on a focus group in Portland. A consumer research company has gathered a cross-section of local drivers to gauge their interest in going electric.
Electric vehicles, first thing that comes to mind.
Probably expensive.
Expensive, okay. Quanta?
Gas saver,
okay. David?
Too small.
All right, Doug, what about you, electric vehicle?
They're kind of a punchline, aren't they?
Many of the participants had a hard time naming even one electric car model. The majority tell moderator John Horvick they would not consider a plug-in car for their next vehicle purchase.
You know, my family's all in Sacramento, so that would be stopping six times, 20 minutes. It's an hour of just waiting to charge to get down there. So
the biggest thing is that replacement battery. I've heard so much bad stuff about that, you know, that's a factor.
The attendees at an electric vehicle conference watched this unfold live via video feed to an auditorium big screen. It's a reality check about how little the average car shopper knows about driving electric, says advocate Jeff Allen.
That's a little bit depressing after 5 years of the Nissan Leaf and the Chevy Volt and dozens of other models available that we're still there.
Allen directs the Electric Vehicle Trade Association Drive Oregon. His nonprofit is prioritizing consumer awareness activities to help sell electric cars.
Just doing ride and drive to get people exposed to the cars. There haven't been nearly enough of those with new electric cars, but there have been almost none of them with used electric cars.
And he thinks that could make a difference. Allen says a lot of electric cars are coming off leases this year and going on the used car market at affordable prices. Mass market plug-in cars first appeared in Northwest dealerships in late 2010. Half a decade later, sales of fully electric and plug-in electric hybrid cars account for less than 2% of all new car sales in Oregon and Washington, and virtually none in Idaho. Tonya Buell with the Washington State Department of Transportation says it's still early in the game.
So the state of Washington has a goal of 50,000 electric vehicles on our roads by 2020, and we're well on our way to reaching that. Right now we have more than 16,000 electric vehicles registered in the state of Washington.
Buell says it was helpful that the Washington legislature earlier this year expanded the range of plug-in models that qualify for a sales tax break. In Portland this past week, major automakers gave a pre-release look at some new battery-powered models. Those include a plug-in hybrid minivan from Chrysler, a longer-range upscale plug-in hybrid Prius from Toyota, and the fully electric Chevy Bolt, a compact advertised to have a 200-mile range. Nissan North America's Director of Government Affairs is Tracy Woodard. She says one thing that should help sales is that the plug-in cars are getting cheaper.
Battery costs are coming down and different models are coming out. I think right now incentives still do matter. We still have the federal tax credit. You've got a state incentive in a lot of these states. I think that definitely helps. Mm-hmm. I think small things like signage for charging infrastructure would go a long way.
Lawmakers in Oregon and California, but not in Washington state, have given environmental regulators the authority to fine automakers who fall short of a complicated zero-emissions vehicle sales threshold. Automakers are meeting the current targets, but the mandate ramps up to a much higher sales volume over the coming decade. I'm Tom Bonsi in Portland.
And I'm Bill Radke at KUOW's The Record. You may have just heard us talk with one of the protesters at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. I want to let you know our reporters, David Hyde and Kate Walters, are at the convention, and you can see their video, the photos they're sending about their journey. All of that is on Twitter at KUOW. And in 30 minutes, the head of Washington State's Democratic Party will tell you, should you be upset about these leaked emails from the Democratic National Committee? Is that the kind of emails you could expect from your state Democratic Party? That's in about 30 minutes from now. Stay tuned to KUOW's The Record. Thank you for tuning into The Record here. Let's talk now about one of the distinguishing features of Seattle, which is our big East African community. There are 25 to 30,000 people living in King County, mostly recent immigrants and refugees from countries like Ethiopia, Somalia, Eritrea. It's one of America's biggest East African communities. These people have had difficult lives already, and you might think it all gets easier when they arrive here. Not so. There is a language barrier. It's hard to find work. And for young East African men, there can be violence.
We had about 4 murders last summer, most of, if not all, which involved young East African men gunned down in our streets.
That is Habtamu Abdi, born and raised in Ethiopia. He told KUOW's Deborah Wong that the Seattle Police Department hired him last year to help build trust between the police and East Africans.
Trust, you know, my personal philosophy is trust is not something you build and then you wrap up and say it's done. Trust is something you continue working on. It's always a work in progress. You know, you cannot say we have built a trust with the East African community and we're done. No, you can lose a trust within, you know, a blink of an eye.
So in your role as a liaison with the community, what do you do personally to try to maintain that trust?
If there is any concerns in the community, I'm the ear and the mouth of the community, and I bring that to the department. We have built different programs specifically targeting East Africans. For example, after I was hired, I created a new event called Coffee with a Captain. What we do is we come together monthly and meet with captains in different precincts. So residents and citizens of each and every neighborhood will have a platform where they come and report, you know, whatever is going on in their neighborhoods at a monthly basis. And I organize different activities. For example, last month we have a holy month of Ramadan, which is, you know, highly respected by East African Muslim community. So Deputy Chief Carmen Best went all the way down to the mosque and broke a bread with the members of the community. And that has a very, very strong message to members of the community. So I do things like that. And pretty much if there is any need for language translations and interpretations, I stepped in.
we've seen so much in the news about other police departments and shootings around the country of black men, tensions rising around in cities around the country about the relationships between police and the black community. And I'm wondering how you feel Seattle is doing overall now in terms of its relationships between police and African Americans or Africans, especially because we've been under the microscope for a number of years.
That's right.
After the Justice Department came in and found that there had been excessive use of force here.
Mm-hmm.
How are we doing now, do you think?
It's a part of human nature. You know, people react whenever things happen. When Seattle, what we're doing differently, which really I was impressed and very proud of working for this department, is we understand people's anger, people's frustrations, and the department is very, you know, politely and professionally addressing those concerns. A good evidence for that is, you know, the chief herself and the deputy chiefs and other, you know, officers going down to the church and meeting with the mothers and pastors before even things happen. Even though it didn't happen here in Seattle, thousands of miles away from here, we proactively reach out to the communities. That way, those problems will not be repeated on our streets here in Seattle.
As a person of color, do you feel any of that? When you say we understand the hurt, do you feel that hurt? Do you feel that anger? I mean, have you had any sort of negative interactions with police that in your life here in Seattle?
Well, one thing needs to be highlighted here. I'm a father myself, you know, and like you said, a person of color, black. And whenever I hear different incidents, like any other citizens, you know, I'll put myself in their shoes. And of course, you know, fear is a part of human nature. I'll put myself, what if my kid was in that place? Like any other parent, I'll be concerned. So, but what makes me stronger and walk away from my fear is that on a daily basis, I try all my best to narrow those communication gaps. That way, I or my kid or somebody who looks like me will not be a victim of that problem.
And what's the response? What response do you hear?
Well, you don't expect uniform kind of response from, you know, such a very diverse community, you know, depending on who you're talking to. And I've run into a meeting where, you know, people just be mad about what happened elsewhere, and they're extremely concerned about the fact that maybe their kid will be next. And like I said, their frustration is very understandable, you know. And then at the same time, I have seen a situation where, you know, even the parents are really concerned about officers being killed here and there. And just like they're concerned for their kids, I've heard the mother saying, those officers are also somebody's kid, somebody's son, and somebody's daughter. So there is a very balanced view when it comes to this incident in our community. The primary roots and the cause of all these problems and all this crisis is the trust and miscommunications. What I do is make sure at the end of the day, nobody benefits from crisis. Nobody benefits from somebody's being killed on the street. I want to see a thriving, successful community. I want to see our kids join colleges and become engineers and doctors and lawyers and live the American dreams they dreamed before they got here. We have seen all kinds of challenges back home. We've gone through many brutalities. So when you get here, we're making sure no minutes or seconds be wasted on any crisis. We rather put all our patience and energies and all the resources we have on positive activities and influence our young men and women. So that's what I preach on a daily basis.
So how does that feel then when you see this situation where young East African men are killed and die by violence on the streets of Seattle? How does that make you feel? I mean, how do you deal with that?
It's very unfortunate. You know, I'll be honest with you. I have attended, if not all, most of those funerals myself in person. So when you have a parent who crossed oceans and, you know, travel through refugee camps and get here and finally they lost their loved ones to gun violence, it really kills you inside. And that's very painful. So it's not only something I do because I get paid. It's something I do because I'm really concerned, because I'm a member of the community myself. And I am raising a kid in this community myself. And it was a wake-up call for all of us last year. Thank God, this year, 2016, we have zero murders in this community so far.
Right.
So, and we're doing well.
Is there any specific thing that you want to see happen or improve between relations between the East African community and police? Is there any one thing that you want to just say, okay, this needs to change?
Well, my hope always is to see young men and women from this community come and join the department. That way, they themselves take the issue of the community to their hands. They themselves will be detectives and investigators. They themselves can patrol their own streets and their neighborhoods. And my vision is to see East African men and women in the command staff, captains, sergeants, lieutenants, detectives. And we have only one officer right now in the department. And there was a time where I said, should I join the department myself and put on that uniform? You know, I was very impressed by the statement made by Chief from Texas after the incident. He said, we're hiring. And if you're really concerned about others targeting your community, come and join and serve your own community.
That is the Seattle Police Department's East African liaison, Habtamu Abdi, telling KUOW's Deborah Wong how we can build some trust between Seattle officers and our big local East African community. You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Here it is, the lunch hour. I'm Bill Radke with KUOW's The Record. Are you eating something that you prepared yourself, something healthy, something delicious that you're enjoying, not at your keyboard, but in a place actually set aside for dining, so that your lunch hour is really a nourishing break from your work? I didn't think so. Junjo Lee didn't think so either. She is a Bellevue-based food ethnographer. She studies the eating customs of different cultures and people. This is how Americans eat.
So there's breakfast, lunch, dinner, but there's also before breakfast snack, between breakfast, lunch snack, and then between lunch and dinner snack, and then after dinner snack, and then late night. So eight occasions. We measure who, what, where, you know, and lunch at work is the most dissatisfying.
Lunch at work, the most dissatisfying American meal. And she is not the only researcher saying that. NPR reported that only one in five American workers takes a lunch break away from their desks. Junjo Lee says that's partly because we might not have access to fresh food. In some workplaces, there is no kitchen, there is no designated eating place. But truly, the sad, shrinking American lunch hour, it's about a bigger issue.
As a society, as a culture, we don't value the lunch hour anymore. So what typically happens is people look at your schedule and they see that, you know, between 12 and 1, it's open. So what we're seeing is a lot of meetings being scheduled during the lunch hour, the typical lunch hour. So it could be that you're on a conference call, even if you're working at home.
So lunch is the worst. How did we get to this point?
We're working more. And women are working more. We're spending more time outside of home in general. So there's been this sort of shift in food culture from a cooking culture or a cook's culture to an eating culture. And so it used to be just a generation ago, if mom cooked, you know, you showed up, you ate what she put in front of you, what she had prepared. And there's no buts about that, right? But now what we're finding is there's typically not that many cooks in the home. So mom or dad or kids might not be cooking. And so once we start devolving from a cooking culture, we are now evolving into an eating culture. And so I think there's just less focus on planning, preparation, you know. And so when you don't have plans made and you're not thinking about what you're going to have for the next meal, it's you don't know what you're going to eat until you're hungry. That's what we found. Oh, I'm hungry. I gotta get lunch.
Isn't there a beauty in that, though? I make it up every day. I had Korean today. You know, tomorrow I might have something different. I'm lucky enough to work near fair amount of options on the Ave.
Yeah, there's actually a beauty in it because it frees up time. It frees up certainly cooking time, cleaning time, and then we're also free to eat about, like eat different types of food. So, you know, eating outside of our family really leads to food exploration and discovery. So, yeah, there is a little bit of beauty to it as well. It's not all sad.
Sure, a lot of oil and sodium in those restaurant meals, though.
Yeah, yeah.
So what are you advocating?
Well, you know, like culture, it's pretty complex. It's less about exactly what you eat, and it's more about how you eat that makes a difference. Tons of snacky type foods, right, you can have for lunch. But, you know, when it comes to creating bonds at work, creating social relationships, and just giving yourself a break in the day, I think it's wonderful. So I think it's thinking about it. We should be a little bit more mindful and decide, is this what we want, rather than being reactive? Because it's pretty important. It's a pretty important time to nourish yourself and give yourself a break and just reconnect with something other than the computer.
Doesn't a longer lunch mean I've just got to spend more time at work? If I can eat while I work, I can get to my kids sooner. I can get to whatever it is faster.
Yeah, that is what it means. But the other side of it is everybody has their computer open. You know what? If everybody took lunch, nobody would be working during that hour, and we wouldn't miss that extra hour of productivity. And maybe it's not so much productivity. Maybe we're, you know, kind of wasting our time. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe there's an undiscovered opportunity.
Right.
It's time for us to remember.
Right. It's just like when we have a holiday, you know, the emails all slow down. The inbox isn't so cluttered because we're all taking a national rest. So what about just a national little, you know, a little beat to rest during the day?
You are a food ethnographer. Are there other cultures besides American culture, Seattle culture, that approach lunch very differently that we ought to think about?
Oh, yeah. I think we're kind of the worst, and we're leading the charge in other countries. So when I did some field work in Mexico, one of the guys was telling me, you know, there's 20 people standing behind me who want my job, so I can't take the traditional Mexican lunch hour or two. So I think it's a condition of modern working and modern living and commuting and
global competition.
Global competition, certainly. But then there are other countries that do it differently. So in China, in Korea, in France, they eat together. So even if it's not provided for them, although the company will often subsidize in Korea, they all leave together. And in fact, when I was working in Korea, I brought my little snacky things for lunch because, you know, that's what I do, right? And I started eating it at the desk. And they said, "What are you doing? What are you eating at your desk?" And they, you know, kind of forced me.
Like, that's weird.
That's weird, right. In China, I think that there's a lot of cafeterias there, and so they do eat together communally as well.
Do you think we can, as a culture, start to change the lunch hour, take it back?
Yes.
From sadness?
Yes, we should start a campaign and take back our lunch hour. I think so.
How would that happen? How would that start?
I think we just need to, you know, it could even be one person in a company or a couple, and just start eating lunch together, even if it's, you know, awkward or odd or and just start talking about it. But certainly companies who get to decide these things can do some, can support their employees.
That's June Jo Lee. She is a food ethnographer based in Bellevue, and she's arguing that American workers need some support so you can take back your lunch hour. Peter Miller is sure on board with that. He is a boss. He owns Peter Miller Books near Pike Place Market, and every day at lunch, he and his employees prepare a meal and eat it together.
If you take that break, the afternoon becomes a separate segment. You're refreshed. You know, it's a little bit like washing your face and hands. Everything just for a moment felt better. I mean, when they give you the warm towel on the plane, you're always surprised that this stupid little towel made such a difference.
So how does lunch go in your company?
The night before, you know, we'll it's sort of an act of what we call cooking over the shoulder of a meal, where you actually say, well, look, I'm already making the pasta. I could certainly throw another half pound of pasta in here. The water's already boiling. All I'm going to do is throw it away. I'm going to sit down to dinner. I'll throw a little extra pasta in for tomorrow, or I'll make a little more pasta, or, you know, I have half a chicken left, or whatever it is. You can make extra rice. So there is some task of keeping in mind and planning for it. And then the next day, we simply look at the situation. Somebody, usually me or someone, will say, you know, I brought this or I brought that. There's only two or three of us, so we're quite quick. Maybe somebody stopped at the market, or, you know, we texted someone and said, would you grab two lemons, or would you grab some lettuce, or, you know, whatever.
Every day. You're making lunch every day?
You make lunch every day. While it sounds to someone saying, geez, I'm not going to make lunch every day, once you actually have this system in place, you're already, if you have rice left over, trying to figure out what you're going to do with it the next day.
Sure, but especially if you have permission from the boss, encouragement from the boss.
Sure. There's a very interesting democracy to eating and certainly to lunch. And when you go to lunch, there's a kind of starting line in which it's very democratic. Everyone has the same status. Some people might be quite good at lettuce. Some people might be quite good at something else. Some people might have brought something that was quite good. It may be that the person of the most power in terms of the office
is in fact me.
But we've had people come visit who have been quite meek in their power of sitting at lunch because that's not what they're good at. They can't make a salad dressing.
Is that a dynamic at work that that during lunchtime, all of a sudden maybe the hierarchy
is a different hierarchy than a work hierarchy.
They're not making any more money.
No.
But they're on top.
If
they can cook.
Right.
In my workplace, we're eating takeout and eating at our desk, a lot of us.
All of you.
You're getting less work done, though, right?
You mean because we're gobbling up so much time making our lunch? No, I think we probably are done in 20 minutes.
Okay.
You know, I think we put it down, we tell stories, it's a thing. Sometimes people will take it and go to their desk because they have something they have to get out. A lot of it has really surprised me. The food is better, obviously. If I make you a salad and you bought the salad that was made in Tukwila this morning at 6 a.m., I'm not going to lose that race.
Right.
I mean, I'll win that. The food is better because it's made right then. We really only allow 15 minutes to make the food, and only one person goes down there to get it all ready. And then everybody shows up, sits down, we eat, we talk, we're done, boop. The person who really can't cook cleans up, and we're back at work.
And what's the surprising effect for you? It does what to you besides give you a nice lunch and 20 minutes with your colleagues?
The surprising effect, and you know, no one's ever said it, but I know every person when I run a bookstore, they don't make any money. Every one of them is pleased that at the end of the week, there's $50 they didn't spend for lunch. And they know it. It's as if you gave them a whole free transport system. And that's important. But that added to the food, added to the fact that you actually, for a minute, sat with everybody and someone said, oh, I had a terrible night or blah, blah, blah. Which something they won't say otherwise. It's an out of time. It's an interesting privacy that you then, at the end of the day, go back to your own privacy. But it creates its own world, just for a second.
Peter Miller, owner of Peter Miller Books near Pike Place Market, and author of Lunch at the Shop, a cookbook of the lunch recipes he and his employees make in the bookstore kitchen every day. In that cookbook, you will not find a recipe for preparing tarantulas, which is a lost opportunity, according to David George Gordon, who wrote the Eat a Bug cookbook almost 20 years ago. He's been evangelizing about eating bugs. He's a member of the Speakers Bureau at Humanities Washington, so he's giving talks and insect cooking demonstrations all around Washington this summer. David Gordon told KUOW's Deborah Wong it all began when he was researching a book about cockroaches.
And I started finding all sorts of stuff about places around the world where people eat cockroaches for medicine or for food. And that kind of led me to an interest of, wow, this is crazy, but people all over the world do that. That's sort of like sparked a question in my mind, you know, why don't we eat bugs? And I kind of explored all of that in my Eat a Bug cookbook.
So what did you do? What was your first bug meal?
You know, the easiest ones to obtain even today are crickets. So first thing I did was I tried crickets in all different ways. I tried frozen crickets that had been defrosted. I tried wild crickets versus the farm-raised crickets you'd buy in a pet store. I even tried cooking with live crickets just to make sure I wasn't missing out on anything there. And I wasn't. So that one took me several months just getting my chops down with crickets. But then I moved on and on. I started cooking with scorpions and tarantula spiders, large grasshoppers, giant Thai water bugs, all sorts of stuff for the course of that book. There's 33 recipes in there, and all but one are original.
And what's your favorite bug?
I'm glad you asked that question. My favorite bug is actually a wax worm, and it's actually sold in pet stores as food or bait and tackle shops. They're actually not worms. They're little white caterpillars, and they're the caterpillars of a moth that lays its egg on the frames of in a beehive. So all those little honeycombs. And when the eggs hatch, the caterpillars eat the wax. So here's a creature that's just been eating honey and wax all of its life. What's not to like about that? They're quite sweet.
So this started out as kind of a novelty for you, something to explore. But make the case to me, because I'm a little bit skeptical. Why should we eat bugs?
Well, there are lots of reasons. And the UN came out with a report through the Food and Agriculture Organization about 4 years ago that really laid it out. This is like a 180-page report, so it wasn't a little pamphlet. In it, they talked about all the environmental benefits. You know, raising crickets is way less wasteful than raising cattle. It takes thousands of gallons of water to get a pound of steak. And these days, water is precious, so that's kind of a giant waste. We can get the same amount of protein from raising crickets, and they also don't require nearly as much food. The amount of food that goes through a cow is shocking. And something like 12 pounds of grain will get you 1 pound of meat. With crickets, it's more like 2 pounds of grain will get you 1 pound of meat. They have all these amazing vitamins and minerals, things you wouldn't get elsewhere, vitamin B12. Vegetarians or vegans have a real issue with vitamin B12, which is only available through living things. Things like calcium, all the omega-3 fatty acids you'd normally get from eating salmon. So there's all sorts of those reasons to eat bugs. But also the reason the Food and Agriculture Administration got into this, the way our population on this planet is growing, they're projecting that by 2040, there'll be another billion people sharing our resources. Those people couldn't all eat hamburgers if they wanted to. Most of our production lands are already in use. So the FAO is actually looking at alternative protein sources and recognizing that 80% of the world's cultures already do eat bugs. They are urging people to start farming as opposed to wild harvesting and eating more bugs.
So if you just want to try to eat bugs, and you might not want to put a tarantula on your plate, what's a good way to sort of start in on this?
Well, people are saying that crickets are indeed the gateway bug because they're so easy to get. But even more importantly, they're being reared expressly for human consumption. And what they're now doing is roasting the crickets and then grinding them up into a very fine powder that you can add as a supplement to things like everything from brownies or pancakes or breads all the way up to like smoothies or milkshakes. Way Back Burgers was actually offering a cricket milkshake last summer as kind of their summer novelty promotion using that cricket powder. And, you know, in Seattle, you can buy cricket powder at a company called Mark's Foods or a Central Co-op. More and more places are starting to carry those. The other thing that I like are cricket energy bars, and those are made with cricket powder. So I think they have like 15 to 20% crickets in their ingredients. They're so flavorful, though, you wouldn't know that there was a bug in there unless I told you so.
So when kids come trick-or-treating to your house, on Halloween, what do you hand out?
You know, I usually don't hand out bugs on Halloween. I think I did that one year. I just had a plate of leftovers from a previous program. But trick-or-treating is one of my favorite holidays, period, Halloween. But I'm pretty conservative about what I hand out. Individually wrapped candies.
So conventional. David George Gordon wrote the Eat a Bug Cookbook, and he's also a presenter with the Speakers Bureau at Humanities Washington. We're tweeting out a link to his website right now, and there is what appears to be a deep-fried tarantula right there on his homepage. I think that's paprika. You can judge for yourself. We're tweeting at KUOW. And a final food note. It is so hot today in Washington, D.C., the National Zoo is serving blood popsicles. Nice and comfortable in Western Washington, and it's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. The latest news from the Democratic National Convention today is that the chair of the Democratic Party, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, will not gavel the convention to order tonight after all. She was going to perform that ceremony even though she's resigned after WikiLeaks dropped 20,000 emails in which party leaders appear to favor Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders. Many Sanders supporters say the emails prove the game was rigged, as they've argued all along, especially here in Washington State where Sanders won our state caucuses. So what does Washington's party chair say about that? Jackson Ravens is at the convention in Philadelphia. I asked him an hour ago whether he sees anything in those emails that says the system is rigged.
Well, I think you're moving a little fast on that. I think there's still a lot of questions. I think that there's still a lot of work that needs to be done in figuring out exactly what is said and how it's said. Debbie Wasserman Schultz deciding to step down as DNC chair is a step in a positive direction. And that's the kind of direction we need to move in on our way to the election in November.
The many Bernie Sanders supporters in Washington state, some of them are saying these are the emails that show the rigged system that we've always complained about. What do you tell them?
Again, there's still information. They're still doing research on this. And, I mean, it's only been a couple days since it's been out. Other things are happening right now at this convention. And I think that's what the focus is on. The focus is on the future of the DNC. It's about moving forward. It's about working together. I mean, we heard Bernie Sanders say this afternoon that we must elect Hillary Clinton. We must work together to defeat Donald Trump and his divisive, hateful rhetoric. And that is the main focus of the conversations that are going on right here in Philadelphia right now. There's obviously a lot going on, but that's the majority of what we're talking about.
When Bernie Sanders said that, we need to concentrate on defeating Trump, he got cheers, but he got plenty of audible boos.
We have got to defeat Donald Trump. And we have got to elect Hillary Clinton and Tim Kaine.
And it reminds us of what happened with Ted Cruz in the Republican convention, and it dominated the news headlines, which I assume you don't want to have happen. So what do you say? Let's talk about some of the specific emails we do. You say we don't. There's a lot we don't know. We know, but we know about some of these emails.
Well,
I can go through them if you like.
I do want to say, yeah, I do want to say that making a comparison between what happened at the Republican convention at the Democratic convention is just not accurate. You know, at the Washington breakfast this morning, I've heard what happened at some of the other breakfasts, but at the Washington breakfast today, and remember, we're 73% Sanders delegates out of the 118 delegates. Mm-hmm. You know, if you looked around the room where we were having breakfast, you couldn't tell where the Sanders delegates were or where the Clinton delegates were. There were a lot of people sitting together having breakfast. We had Governor Inslee there. We had Congressman DelBene there, both talking about the work that needs to be done to move forward in Washington State and in this country. And everybody clapped and cheered. And we were excited and we were happy.
You don't think there'll be boos tonight from the Washington delegation when Bernie Sanders says the problem is Donald Trump, and doesn't talk about a rigged system in the Democratic Party?
Yeah, there are some people who are upset about, you know, about the situation, and they really wanted Bernie to stay in the race, and they wanted to kind of move forward on a bunch of stuff, and that frustration and that is understandable. But I think that at the same time, there is an awareness that the real enemy here is Donald Trump and his hateful, divisive rhetoric. And that's not just Donald Trump, but it's up and down the Republican ticket. And so as we saw in 2008, when Obama got the nomination and a lot of the Hillary supporters at that time had their own questions and concerns about going forward with their work and support, ultimately, we all pulled together to make it happen and to have a successful election in 2008. We're going to do that again here in 2016. It might take a little bit of time, but we're going to be heading in the right direction.
So as chair of the Washington State Democratic Party, Jackson Ravens, are you saying that these emails are not evidence of a rigged system? We really should expect that party officials, they want to win. If they think that Hillary Clinton is the most electable, that's certainly their right to say so and express that and even try to get the candidate they think is most electable, Hillary Clinton, to victory. Are you saying basically these emails are awkward, embarrassing, but it's the real world and get over it?
No, that's not what I'm saying.
How should upset Sanders support? You're saying there's a lot we don't know and that we want the focus to be this. Yes, there's a lot of other things to focus on. I'm just trying to, as someone, you are a party insider. We just got an insight into emails from party insiders at the national level, and I'm trying on behalf of Democrats, Bernie Sanders supporters and not, to figure out,
right.
You know a lot, Jackson Ravens, about this. How should we feel about those emails?
Well, again, I am waiting to see what the final results are on this. I know we've gotten some of the information. I know that there were mistakes that were made. I know that we've got some new leadership coming into the DNC, and they've talked very openly about kind of cleaning house and making sure that people aren't making stupid mistakes. And so I'm excited about that. I mean, the focus here and the focus that we're seeing at the DNC is about how we can move forward, not how we can move backward. And that is what we are excited about. And I know that this is not going to be something that's just going to be, you know, this is an issue, obviously, that deserves some serious attention. And we're going to focus on it. We're going to get some answers to it. But I think at this point, a couple of days out, given everything else that's going on these couple of days at National Convention, that we just need to give it a little bit of time, let things settle, and we're going to take a look at it, and then we're going to have some answers on how we're going to move forward with that.
Okay. We'll let things settle, and we'll see what other information we get. If the Washington State Democratic Party got WikiLeaked, would we find very similar statements in email from you and other state officials?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, no. I've been really proud of myself, my staff, all the workers at the Washington State Democratic Party. And you can ask a lot of the Sanders supporters in Washington State that we've just been a very fair and balanced state party. And we've worked very strongly with both groups. And as I said, at our breakfast this morning, Governor Inslee, Congresswoman Del Bene were up in front of the group of our delegation and our guests and were warmly welcomed with applause and praise for a lot of the work that they're doing and the values that they have. And I'm proud of being the head of a party that is focused on that unifying message going forward.
Going forward, that's your state party Democratic chair, Jackson Ravens, at the convention in Philadelphia. His counterpart at the Democratic National Committee headquarters is leaving her post. And today, Florida Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz also said she will not gavel the party's convention to order as she had planned to do. She says she wants the convention to begin on a high note. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Good to be with you today. Amazon sends you stuff fast. That doesn't mean the stuff is authentic. Now, Birkenstock says it will stop selling its sandals on Amazon because of all the Birkenstock knockoffs for sale there. Here to tell you the truth is Todd Bishop, the authentic Todd Bishop with Seattle's tech news site GeekWire. Hey, Todd.
How's it going, Bill?
Good. Is Birkenstock pulling out of Amazon totally or just the third-party sales we call Amazon Marketplace?
Entirely. Birkenstock itself will stop selling on Amazon, and they're preventing third parties from selling. And they say there's just been too many counterfeit shoes that have been showing up. And this is a much larger problem for Amazon. It's something that they've dealt with in the past.
Right. Daimler Mercedes sued them. Is Amazon trying to police its marketplace?
They are. The issue is that they just have this giant online marketplace. It's you know, black market, gray market, you know, above board. And when you get into the Amazon marketplace, third-party sellers, it can be a bit of a Wild West. The other company that dealt with this was a Seattle company by the name of Milo and Gabby, which
right.
makes very cute pillowcases that you can put on your kids' beds. They found a bunch of knockoffs, sued Amazon, and actually lost that judgment. However, the judge who issued the ruling said, hey, the issue is the law is not strong enough here. He actually thinks that legislators should come back and make Amazon liable for third-party counterfeit goods sold on its site, which it currently is not.
What are the odds legislators do that?
Wow. In Washington State, it might be difficult. Amazon is becoming an increasingly large employer here, very influential. And they, at the national level, have also boosted their lobbying, mostly for drones. But they also have a big presence that could potentially influence a debate over this.
CNBC reported that at its warehouses, Amazon mixes up authentic products and fakes. Have you heard that? Can that be right?
I have not seen that myself. I'd only have to rely on CNBC for that. Amazon has not commented on these developments. And in fact, because a lot of these cases have gone into litigation, they're even more closed-mouthed than they usually are.
Amazon would like to improve its image in Seattle by giving tours of its new South Lake Union headquarters. What did you learn from the tour that you didn't already know?
A lot of different things about the origin of Amazon building names. The one thing we did not see, however, this is their first official headquarters tours. They're sold out, so tons of demand. Not nearly as much, though, as for the Boeing factory tour quite yet.
Right, or the KUOW studios.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But Amazon is really trying to get across its cultural impact and its impact on the city. They really stressed the importance of growing inside Seattle rather than in the suburbs because they feel it's better for the environment, better for employees. Of course, this is in stark contrast to the reports that have come out in recent years, most recently the New York Times, about the brutal workplace. Mm-hmm. Now, we really did not get a real glimpse into the Amazon workers' life. It was mostly hallways and corridors, and we didn't get to look over any coders' shoulders.
Right. No surprise there. Did you get to tour the bubbles?
We did not tour the bubbles.
The biospheres.
The biospheres. These are the new structures going up at Amazon's very new campus in the Denny Regrade, the Denny Triangle. And those are still under construction. But in the future, you could expect those to be included on this tour.
Finally, you noticed a poster in an elevator that broke some news?
That's right. It's called Daily Dish, new workplace lunch delivery service from Amazon. The real kicker here is that it competes directly with a startup called Peach, founded in 2014 by three former Amazonians. So the message here is, hey, if you're going to leave the nest, be prepared to be squashed.
That's Todd Bishop bringing you the real news. Those are actual Echoes he's wearing, not fake Birkenstocks. Telling us the deal with Amazon. Thanks a lot, Todd.
Thank you, Bill.
Todd Bishop with Seattle's tech news site GeekWire here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. We're live tweeting the show, as always, at KUOW. Join us on Facebook, KUOW Public Radio. And as we said, if you've got a question about the national convention, send email to newsroom@kuow.org. We've got David Hyde and Kate Walters in Philadelphia all this week.